Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
And as always, just very proud and happy and glad to be talking to the most alert, aware audience in the world, I'm sure. In the whole area of psychiatry and psychology and mental health and helping children and helping adults in difficult emotional and real life situations. A group of people devoted to empowering other people. Today I'm going to skip talking at all about anything going on with me because we have a real treat here. Not that my other guests aren't a treat, but we have Sammy Tamimi on the phone from Great Britain. Sammy, are you there?
I'm here, yes. Hello, Peter.
Oh, hi. It's really a pleasure and an honor to have you on.
Sammy
is a child psychiatrist. In this country, a child psychiatrist is a slot machine that you plug your health care card into and out comes some drugs for your kid, and you don't even have to hang around. Sammy is, in my experience, the most subtle, caring of child psychiatrists. I'm not sure I know anybody quite comparable, Sammy, to you anywhere in the world. And to me of great interest, and we kid about this, is that Sammy works within the institutional system of Great Britain. Folks, it would not be possible for Sammy, I believe, to work within any kind of institutional system in the United States. Sammy is really oriented to what's best for the kids, what's best for the children, rather than what's best for me, the pharmaceutical industry, my institution, my organization. Sammy is what's called a consultant in child and adolescent psychiatry. A consultant in Great Britain, I think, means that he is somebody that kids get referred to by general practitioners and others a little lower down the food chain, so to speak. And so that he's there kind of looking over things and seeing kids who need special help. And that's in the National Health Service in Great Britain. And he's also a director of medical education at his particular program. And he's a visiting professor of psychiatry and mental health at the University of Lincoln in the UK. See, Sammy does a lot of things which have always impressed me as both caring and practical and down to earth. And what do I do about the kids? Talking with Sammy is part of the decision I made to have each author from the Sedated Society, by James Davies, come on the show, and we're going to have all but one who's on leave for a year. I don't think he's going to come forward and break up his year away. But each person's going to come along in the next few weeks, and we're going to really cover the book and also the editor, James Davies. So let me spell Sammy Tamimi for you. It's S-A-M-I. That's Sammy, S-A-M-I, Tamimi, T-I-M-I-M-I, T-I-M-I-M-I. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter.
We were talking in the beginning about the whole idea of childhood depression, if you'd like to address that or anything you'd like to begin with.
Yeah, just maybe just picking up on a few things that you were mentioning about my role, and thank you for that introduction, I'm not sure I would go along with as effusively as you have, Peter. You made me remember speaking to a highly esteemed colleague from the U.S., from Arizona. I'm not sure if you've come across him. His name's Bob Bohansky, and he's the clinical lead of a large mental health organization down there doing some great work. And he was on a visit to the UK a few years back. He's actually visited a couple of times. And he was really fascinated by us having the title consultant psychiatrist, because he was saying the psychiatrists in his organization are all called prescribers, and that's what they are referred to, which for me seems a very odd idea, that a psychiatrist is kind of reduced to merely their role in prescribing. Is that a fairly accurate reflection of how psychiatry has come to be viewed in the US, as predominantly your role is in prescribing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about the metaphor I introduced, which is that in America, psychiatrists are like slot machines. You stick your... Yeah. The parents come by and stick their health insurance card into the slot machine, and they leave, and out comes some drugs that the kid gets. And by and large, they're not really great people, frankly. I mean, they're people who don't engage with children. It's a disaster over here. I saw a little girl several years ago, but I think while I was here in Ithaca, and she's about 10 years old. She came in with her parents, and she looked around my office, which is really not just – it's not an office. It's a very nice office living room kind of space, and it's got lovely pictures on the walls, and you can barely see my credentials. I have two that are required by law, and you can find them if you need to on the wall. And she looks at me, and she says, "Wow, is this different?" And I said, "How's it different?" And she said, "Well, have you ever tried to talk to a wall with ears and a pad?"
Yeah.
So I think it is pretty bad here.
It seems a real shame that it's ended up like that. I mean, it has kind of gone somewhat in that direction in the UK, but I think we still have a reasonably lively opportunities for lively debate and disagreement amongst us. Because, I mean, one of the reasons I came into psychiatry was because it was the branch of medicine that, to me, offered that whole patient in their context perspective, which is something that I think is important for all of medicine, this idea that real people aren't just, you know, what's going on in their kidneys or what's going on in their liver. When people are suffering, there's a whole sort of knock-on effects all around them. Now, particularly when we come to mental health, because we're in an area where it's you can't escape having to engage, as far as I can see, you can't escape having to engage with the multifaceted nature of being a human. You can't escape having to engage with these bigger questions about what it means to be human, what it means to suffer, and this idea that I think we this kind of slightly brings me back to the whole notion of childhood depression. I think culturally there has been, probably since the advent of painkillers, a notion that all suffering can somehow be eliminated, and that all suffering is necessarily bad, and that there's nothing that people can learn or can understand or can extract meaning out of distress or suffering. And I think that's a problematic notion to me. And I'm not saying here that we shouldn't be engaging engaging with suffering. On the contrary, what I'm saying is that we should be engaging with suffering. We should understand that as people in our lives, for many of us, we're not going to be able to avoid discomfort, displeasure at various parts of our lives. Part of that is about growing up. Part of that is to do with things, bad things being done to us, whether it's abuse, whether it's abuse of power, whether it's you know, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, or whether it's going through traumatic incidents. But these things that happen to people are not without meaning. These things are meaningful events in people's lives. And to treat them as if they are the result of some kind of unseeable goings-on somewhere in the brain, which can be fixed magically with some sort of what I think of as, you know, as some fantasy fairy dust that we call medication, I think is a very dangerous way of not just for the individuals concerned, for their families, but also more broadly for us as a culture. It's kind of mystifying the nature of suffering, and it's meaning that we're getting... It becomes more difficult to view engagement with suffering as a normal part of life, and particularly for us as parents who are bringing up children, that this idea that we can pass these things on to various people who are called experts who will kind of magically take it away means that as parents sometimes we're distancing ourselves from that messy business of being there with our children, helping guide them through all of these obstacles that happen in people's lives. I'm wittering on a bit, but
no, you're doing great, Sammy. Thank you.
What I'm talking about, because really, what I'm talking about is in the chapter that I was writing. One of the things that I wanted to talk about before I actually talked about the evidence, or rather, the lack of evidence for the usefulness of what we call or what we mislabel as antidepressants, is that long before that, we need to be thinking of where has the notion of depression come from, and particularly where has the notion of childhood depression come from. Does that make any sense to you, Peter?
Total sense, 100%. Please go on, Sammy, and talk about the notion of childhood depression and where it comes from. Very important, folks.
Yeah. So, like I was saying, one of the things that I think began to happen in our culture, and I believe it's partly related to originally the development of being able to control pain, but since then we've kind of extended that to all sorts of different notions of suffering. So the concept of, the word depression is interesting. And it's interesting in terms of the way our language has changed. So when I was, I have a bit of a complicated background, which I won't go into, but in the part of my life where I was growing up in this country, which was in my later adolescence onward, I don't remember any of my peer group talking about feeling depressed. It simply wasn't a word that was being used. So you talk about feeling miserable or feeling unhappy or sad or frustrated more what you might think of as everyday words. But my children, who are now, they're both on their way to university. Well, the younger one has just started university this year, so they're both at university. But throughout their growing years, they and their peer group would use the word depressed to describe themselves, which is, as you know, a term that was introduced as a medical term. So even everyday language has somehow got colonized by this idea that there's something specific called depression. So that instead of thinking in more everyday language, like feeling unhappy, feeling miserable, we talk about now feeling depressed. Is that something that you notice in the U.S. as well?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the ways that I've occasionally gotten enraged responses from my colleagues, especially years ago when they were more willing to talk with me, is I would talk about unhappiness.
Yes.
And I'd say giving pills for unhappiness, and that they would shriek because this undermined everything. They'd say, no, it's a disease. It's not unhappiness. This is ridiculous. And they get very, very angry.
Yeah,
so I think you're at the
unhappy.
Root of something extremely important.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you differentiate this idea of something that you call depression versus something that you call unhappiness? Even deep unhappiness or misery, you know.
Yes.
So that's kind of a few things in general about the notion of depression. And in terms of the notion of childhood depression, so I did my training in child psychiatry in the early to mid 90s, and in the textbooks that we were using at that time, even as late as, you know, the early 90s, childhood depression was mentioned in passing in the textbooks as something that was rare, that it didn't respond to medication, that was usually related to various psychosocial factors, and that was different to adult depression. The notion that there is childhood depression that looked like adult depression, that was very common and that was potentially amenable to antidepressants, really only started taking root in the 90s as a number of people started, mainly in the U.S., writing books and articles about under-recognition of childhood depression. And basically they were confusing, I think, what we used to look at and call unhappiness or sadness or miserable, and sometimes even just frustration or being irritable, or, you know, all sorts of things started being labeled as depression and being spoke about as if it is similar to adult depression, and also being spoken about that if we didn't treat it, it will go on to become chronic depression, and that we need to start taking childhood depression more seriously, because, you know, what happens is when there's something new to market from the pharmaceuticals, they'll find a few so-called key opinion leaders, people who are happy to go along with their corruption. I'm afraid I have no time or empathy towards people who are prepared to just take money for the sake of the advancements of their career and not look a bit more deeply at what they're up to when they do that. So I feel I don't look terribly favorably on those who are involved in this kind of marketization of the concept of depression, because what happened is that they started talking about hidden epidemics. This I'm sure will be familiar to you, Peter, that when you want to start selling something, you talk about hidden epidemics, and we've got the treatment for it. And so the idea of using what we call antidepressants for children started taking off and being written about and being recommended long before we had actually any studies, any proper randomized control trial studies. Of course, the early ones were done by the pharmaceutical company, and there's a few famous ones like Study 329, which has been where another group of researchers got hold of all the research papers and showed quite convincingly that it was a total fraud, that they had made claims for benefit where even their own research didn't find benefit, and they had completely left out all the adverse effects, including kind of suicidality and aggression and changes in personality and so on.
That was Paxil. Wasn't that GSK and Paxil?
That's right. Yes.
I don't mind. I don't mind saying, you don't want to, maybe you want to say the name, but I'll say the name, GSK and Paxil. And folks, on my website, I've got three articles, part 1, 2, and 3, about the fraud involved in the development and salesmanship of Paxil. Unfortunately, every time I get more information, you often as a medical expert, about what the drug companies do, it's actually more typical than not for them to just bend the truth desperately to make a living out of selling toxic substances to people.
Yeah, it is shameless. It is shameless. Yeah, so by the late 90s, the whole idea of childhood depression had sort of taken root. So it happened in a very short time. And once it had taken root and people were prescribing medication before there were the studies, just on the basis that they were now being talked about in the same way that adult depression was being talked about. So the prescribing to children of the SSRI antidepressants started long before there was any evidence for it and has continued since. It did have a very interesting hiatus, which was after the Panorama program, which is a well-known documentary, primetime documentary program in the UK. So they aired a program in 2003. By then, there'd been a good few years of prescribing SSRIs to children. And in this program, there were a number of cases that were talked about and a number of ongoing legal cases which talked about children and young people being put on these SSRIs, experiencing suicidal thoughts and some of them sadly committing suicide, which was followed a prescription when the people who knew these kids talked about how there'd been a change in their personality and they hadn't been suicidal before, but they became suicidal afterwards and so on. So what had happened after the Panorama program is the makers of that program received thousands of phone calls and emails talking about similar reactions in their children, and it forced the Committee for Safety of Medicine in this country to launch an investigation. And that was the first we heard about some of the buried data from the drug companies that showed that young people who were in these studies, who were on an SSRI compared to those who were on a placebo in the studies, were more than twice as likely to experience suicidal thoughts and suicidal events. So this had been studied. So the Committee for Safety of Medicine produced new guidelines and a new warning saying that we shouldn't be using the SSRIs in people under 18. But they did spare, I think, incorrectly. Well, I'm pretty sure incorrectly on the evidence that I've seen. They did spare Prozac. There's no reason to think Prozac would be any different to the other SSRIs, and indeed it isn't. It's just that the studies that were available at the time concealed these problems better than the other studies, I think. That's my conclusion. But also, I think regulatory bodies like that are quite wary of making blanket bans like that, because if there is already widely established practice, then it causes them quite a few problems, or at least they perceive that it's going to cause quite a few problems because it's going to disrupt so many doctors' existing practice, if that makes any sense. So sadly, they spared Prozac. So after a period where antidepressant prescribing leveled off for a couple of years in this country. It then started to rise again in about 2006 or so, and has continued to rise in terms of the number of people being prescribed antidepressants in this country. And I believe there was a similar pattern in the U.S.
So, Sammy, and folks, we're talking to Sammy Tamimi from Great Britain. And Sammy's last name is spelled, first name is S-A-M-I, and then T-I-M-I-M-I. It sounds like the situation in Great Britain is similar to U.S. in that the government didn't outlaw any use of antidepressants. No. It just suggested against them in children except for Prozac. So people could still do what they wanted. Docs could still prescribe.
Yes. I think so the trends that I've looked at, as I say, after the warning was produced, and I think you had a similar warning in the U.S. about a year later from the Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah, ours was in about 2004. The hearings were 2004, and by 2006, there were huge warnings in all the labels about suicide, but also about a whole activation syndrome that I wrote about. One thing you probably don't know, I was very pleased about, is that I wrote an article in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine in which I emphasized not just suicide and violence, but a stimulant activation. Or activation syndrome. Yeah. That includes aggression and hostility, and also just loss of control, disinhibition, insomnia, all the way up to mania. And the person who was in charge of managing the committee hearings, for whatever reason, got in touch with me and asked me to print up 25 or 30 copies of it and ship it to them because they wanted to give a copy to each of the members of the committee. And a lot of what's in the label reads like the article of mine warning not just about the suicide and depression, which was also my testimony, was it's not just suicide and depression or suicide and worsening condition. It's a better description than depression. Worsening condition, it's about all these horrendous adverse effects that are similar really to cocaine or amphetamine. That string of warnings would fit for any drug that gets stimulating to the person.
Mm. It is quite disheartening that there wasn't stronger warnings, because after a period where it looked like the idea that antidepressants can be prescribed without too much shaking of the physician's hands, it looked like that era was kind of coming to an end, as all these studies were coming out, or rather the buried data from the drug company studies was coming out, showing that they are actually pretty harmful, and there was very little evidence when you look at properly done studies that they produce any benefit. In fact, if you look at the studies that have been done of SSRIs in young people, I can't think of one study which has been a proper randomized control trial where they're comparing an SSRI against a sugar pill, where neither the participant or the doctor knows whether they're taking the drug or the sugar pill, where on the basis of the ratings made by the young people or made by their parents, that there is any significant differences between the placebo and the active drug. The only difference
other than the horrible side effects from the drug, which you don't get with the placebo.
Well, yes, in terms of benefits, there is very little to suggest that there is anything beneficial over and above taking a sugar pill, taking a placebo pill. So that's why the overall evidence, pretty convincingly, not pretty, convincingly full stop, shows that overall SSRIs cause more harm than benefit. That's, I think, what the literature out there says. Yeah. The reason why Prozac was spared was largely because of this habit that drug companies have of data mining. So they'll use a number of different measures, and they will find a measure that they can find significant differences on. So in the Prozac ones, where they did find a significant difference, it was on measures made by the clinician, not by the young, not ones filled in by the young person or their parents. So that's where
that's really important for people to know. The distortions are rather beyond belief. But psychiatric drugs get approved when the patients haven't said that they're helped. They get approved when the psychiatrist says they were helped.
It's
and
not
the
quite
psychiatrist
like that,
can usually
Peter?
Tell
because
who's on what on the drug
because,
and who's on the sugar pill.
It's not that they've said that they've not helped, strictly speaking, because
they've not
helped any more than a placebo has helped. In other words, it's not the chemical that's helped, it's the act of being with and seeing a doctor who's interested in you, who's trying to help you, who's talking to you about how things are going and so on. That's what's helping. But people, because actually quite a few people get helped just by this non-specific factor,
Sam, because I'm so glad you... I did misspeak that you corrected me about that. And it's really worth looking at a little more. And everything helps people, especially people who are feeling down, helpless, blue, paralyzed in their emotions. Almost anything that is a caring intervention or an interesting intervention or a new idea will help because it's about hopelessness. And if you give people hope, whether it's a pat on the shoulder or reassurance that things are going to get better, or a family member intervening, whatever. So many things help overcome what we call depression because it's human beings feeling overwhelmed and helpless. And it's the same with kids. They get apathetic. They get withdrawn, apathetic, sad, overwhelmed by divorce in the family, by child abuse.
By real things that are going on.
Real issues. Let's switch to that.
People often feel that, when they're really feeling down and feeling helpless, it's often very difficult to connect the dots. And one of the things that I think we can do is help people connect the dots, because I have a rough rule of thumb. And my rough rule of thumb is when bad things happen in your life, don't be surprised that you feel bad. It's a rough rule of thumb of how we operate as people, isn't it? And so that's something that we can do, because when people are kind of in the grips of feeling helpless and desperate, they can't quite connect the dots. They kind of feel that it must be something about how bad they are, about what a failure they are, about how hopeless they are, what a useless person they are, and things like that. And sometimes it is just about helping people say, do you know what? I would be more surprised if you weren't feeling down, given what you've told me about what's been going on, over the last few years or earlier in your childhood, or etc. It's about demystifying our emotions, and this is one of the problems, I think, when we get too caught up with the idea that there are these discrete conditions out there. One of them is called depression, and it's somehow something that can only be identified, understood, and diagnosed by some specialist doctor. I mean, we're not looking inside anybody's brains or doing anything like that. So I think that's one of the things. But I do think it's important to mention this placebo effect, that because a lot of people listening might have had an experience of being prescribed one of these medications and thinking, well, it worked for me. I started to feel better, you know? And many doctors who might be listening will be thinking, I don't know what they're talking about because, you know, I've had patients, I've prescribed this, and they've got better. Because there is such a high placebo response, people are regularly confusing the idea that it was the drug that got them better than all the rituals around the drug that they were involved in, with people being interested and caring and giving them time and giving them space. And those are the things that have helped, because that's what the evidence says. It's the placebo response that's going on. It's the all the rituals around the medication. But the actual chemical effect is overall harmful. That's what the studies show.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. I do want to address one part, and it sort of has a is a conflicting notions between placebo and what I'm about to say, which is building on your concept, and I've not quite heard it put just that way, that the whole problem starts with the narcotic painkillers. So we get the idea that we can kill pain, and then we extend it. You didn't specifically say it to emotional pain, but that's what you're saying, is that then it gets expanded to emotional pain. And I think that any psychoactive substance, any significantly strong psychoactive substance, is essentially a not caring drug. And I talked a lot about this when I did my special show 2 weeks ago on the antipsychotic drugs. And a lot of people do get an indifference, an apathy, a lack of caring from any psychoactive substance, whether it's the wine you drink at night and you don't deal with your wife and kids, or marijuana.
We have this artificial separation between illegal psychoactives and legal psychoactives, but many of them have different varieties of numbing yourself, numbing your experiences.
So I think that's the active thing that separates placebo at times from the drug, but it's not a good thing.
I agree, and I would extend that to one of the most important things for me when I'm working with people. And I do accept, you know, we all have complicated lives, and that sometimes it feels as if we have no resources to deal with things. But one of the important things for me is when change, positive change happens, it is understood by the people that we're working with that it is them who've brought about that positive change. Because I can't do it. I can't live their lives. I can only be somebody who is there to help make sense of something, to give some ideas. But it is always the people who go away and make this real in a way that makes sense to them in their lives. And that's the thing that I worry most about. Well, it's one of the things I worry about when it comes to using medications like SSRIs to help people through these difficult periods, is that they then ascribe the reason for things improving to taking this medication. Now, that is profoundly disempowering, because it confirms that there was something faulty and broken with them. It confirms that when they next have a period in their life where they're facing some struggles and some difficulties, that they do not have the resources, either in themselves or in their social network, to be able to find a way through it, and that they are going to need pharmaceuticals. And this is how I think is a really big issue for me when it comes to children, because this is a bit like what I call the McDonaldization. You're creating consumers for life, potentially, by starting them young with this idea that there is some faulty chemicals in their brain, and that in order to deal with it, you have to take these medications. There's no reason then for them to assume that as they go through their life that this isn't the way that they get out of troubles in their life in the future. So I think this thing about ownership of recovery or improvement by the young person, by the family, by the social network, by people who are directly involved, is very important.
It's astonishing, you know, how much we think alike about all of this. I think that there's something good going on in the world right now, in that when I talk to therapists, a lot of folks, we seem to have developed on our own largely from working with people very similar ideas about what people really need, about the importance of empowering people. And that's one of the good things that comes out on the radio show. But I see that with folks who just aren't even politically involved with psychiatric reform. I had a quick thing I wanted to clear up, and then I wanted to shift more to helping people. When you were talking about childhood depression, you were really talking about all of depression, I believe. But we got so focused on childhood, I don't want folks thinking that Sammy believes that adult depression is more real than childhood depression. So I want to check that out, make sure we have the same understanding about that.
Yes. I just have to be careful about language here, because sometimes if people hear me saying something like, it's a social construct, that I'm minimizing people's experience. So when I'm saying, because you use the phrase not real, in terms of it's not a disease state in the same way, for example, heart failure is a disease state. There is a physiological process going on. We can measure it. We can have tests to identify the degree to which it's happening. So depression is very real experiences, very painful, some of the most desperate experiences that people will ever go through, but it is not a disease state. That's what I mean, and I do mean that for all of depression. Yeah. I guess I was focusing particularly on childhood because that's where my work is. That's where I work as a consultant.
I knew that. I just wanted to help people understand that. And I'm in 100% agreement with you, too, about everything you just said about the real disaster, the tragedy of those feelings which can overcome people and lead to suicide. And they're very real and have to be dealt with in a very real way. I'd like to switch more to that now. We can still stay focused on children. You know, in my experience, Sammy, I rarely see children alone, certainly pre-adolescent children, because I try to get across to the families who come to me and bring in a child or more, or several children, that it's in our hands as the adults to figure out what in the world has happened here and why is there this distress in the family. Children are often like the canary in the mine shaft. You know, they're the ones showing the symptoms of something much greater going on around them. But incidentally, I also tell the children in front of their parents, and even I tell them, and even if your parents don't change and figure out what happened, you got to do it because it's your life. You got to take charge of your life. You can't just sit back and hear me talking about let's make changes in the family and say my parents are to blame, because actually you're only going to succeed as you grow up by taking charge of your own life. very similar principles, but I wonder, do you work with children individually who are small, or do you work pretty much basically with the family like I do?
See, I consider myself a traditional child psychiatrist. So when I did my training in child psychiatry, as I say, in the early to mid-90s, it was very much conceived of as a area of medicine that looked at context and development. So context is that you cannot understand children without understanding the context in which they exist. For a start, most of the decisions in their life are not going to be taken by them, but it's going to be taken by a series of adults in various caring relationships to them. And the second one is development. And I just take a very broad view of development, the idea that as you grow, things will change. So one of the things I often tell parents is that one thing I can, there's very little I can predict with certainty, but one thing I can predict with pretty good certainty is in a few years' time, your child will be different. I don't know in which way he'll be different or she'll be different, but I know they'll be different because that's what happens with development. So most of my work is with families. That's the bread and butter of my work. I do have some older adolescents who want to kick their parents out of the room, and that's fine by me if that's what they want to do and their parents are happy with that, who I would work with more individually. But most of my work is with parents.
See, again, it's so interesting to talk to you about this in more detail because I operate in exactly the same way from what you're saying. And, of course, I'm not a child psychiatrist. I didn't have extra special training or residency in child. But, you know, if you do adult psychiatry, you learn all about childhood. It goes both ways. And
absolutely.
I think working with children is so wonderful, Sammy, because you can sometimes, for me, I can sometimes in the first session see things that are happening and affecting the child adversely that the parents actually have a sense of and really welcome my coaching them about. Whereas if I'm seeing the child at age 40, they will have no ability or very little to know what happened to them. Is that your experience too?
I'm not sure about the older adults, about their still being connected, but it does come up certainly in some of the work that I am involved with families, is that we end up talking about how, essentially how the parents were trained to be parents. And I use that word trained to be parents themselves, because we pick up our ideas about how to do these different things in our lives from, a lot of it comes from the people around us, and particularly during our childhoods, and particularly from our parents. So you get your ideas about how to be a parent from what I call the training you received from your parents. And a lot of it is kind of accidental stuff that happens. I mean, the people who fill my consulting rooms, and I suspect that's similar for most psychiatrists, are people where unfortunate and painful things have happened in their lives. Exploring those is part of, for me, the bread and butter of the work that we do. And sometimes parents have some very strong ideas and very lively ideas. And one of the hardest things for me to work with is an understanding that when parents come, they often feel very guilty underneath. And because they feel very guilty, there can, for some of them, there's often a veneer of defensiveness. They're very afraid of where you're going to go with your questioning. And so for some, there is a false reassurance in the idea that it's their children who've got some condition because they're secretly being persecuted by this idea that they're a bad parent. But what I tell my parents very early on is to try and get it out in the open, is that in my experience, the bottom line for all really caring parents is that they spend most of their life feeling guilty about their children and feeling guilty about what they do. Anybody who's a parent knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah? Oh, God, yes.
And that kind of opens, because what I've seen as well over the years is people who've ended up with their children being diagnosed with this and that and then had that initial thing of relief, that guilt thing never goes, and it's never been spoken about. So I try and get that one out in the open quite early on to enable us at least to deal with that and to accept that, and that it's okay. It's okay to feel guilty. Most of us do when it comes to our children. And sometimes that guilt...
Sammy, I just want to say, that is a really beautiful idea. Yeah. I'm going to do more of just what you said. That's a really good way to put it. All of us who are caring parents end up feeling guilty about our children because we wanted to give them a life so much better than our own, and we don't have it in our power. We make mistakes, and sometimes they do really great, and sometimes not. But the guilt we feel.
Sometimes one of the issues that I found happens is because parents are feeling guilty, they're trying too hard almost to fix something. And sometimes that in itself can start causing problems of resentment or tension, because it can change a relationship to being a relationship that's built around ongoing worry that there's something wrong, that there's something that needs to be fixed. And when your child won't do the things that you think they need to do to fix it, it creates more problem, more tensions. So one of the things that I'm involved with I've taken up some of the ideas developed by, have you heard of Howard Glasser, who developed the Nurtured Heart approach?
Howie's a dear friend of mine. I actually wrote the introduction to his new book coming out.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. So, I love the Nurtured Heart approach, and we've sort of taken it on and put more systemic ideas and various things into it. So we now call it, so we have a group approach called the Relational Awareness Program. And it is just about focusing on relationships and what happens when we're worried about our kids. How does that affect our relationships with them? And just focusing on working on developing more positive relationships, and relationships that are not dominated by these worries, these guilts, these attempts to constantly try and fix something.
By the way, folks, Howie has been on this show, and you can go on my website. Remember, unlike going on to the internet, but if you go onto my website and pick up the radio shows, you can actually search the radio show for my guests. And Howie Glasser has been on a few times, but it inspires me to think it's time to have Howie on again. His theme is the greatness of children and how you want to not just nurture kids, but love their greatness and appreciate their greatness. And
yes.
We parents lose track of that all the time. And I like everything you're saying, Sammy. I think what you've said about the worry, your parents end up becoming intrusive and losing their boundaries with their kids because they're so worried and so concerned. One of the things I'll tell parents when I meet the 6-year-old or the 8-year-old who looks to me like he or she's perfectly sound human being, I'll say to the parents, you know, you've mostly done your job now already.
Yeah.
Look, your daughter doesn't do a lot of dope.
See, I think the other things that are also more broadly cultural that maybe doesn't help this is that two things. Firstly, we have so many systems of surveillance out there now that kids can't just be kids just messing around in there's all these, whether it's at school, whether it's in organized activities, there's always people around who are going to be commenting on and thinking, oh, that's not quite right. So it's become harder than ever just to be a normal, or no, an ordinary kid. So that's one thing that I think puts a lot of pressure on parents. And the other thing that I think puts a lot of pressure on parents, and these are all kind of things that it's very hard to get to grips with because they're in there, if you like, in the cultural ether. But I do try and have these conversations with parents, is that we have a way of viewing kids as being potentially vulnerable rather than noticing their resilience. So there's all these various discourses around about all the dangers that are awaiting our children at every corner in their lives, whether it's dangers from not succeeding academically or dangers from members of the public abusing them or road traffic or whatever it is, you know. So this discourse about danger, which leads people to have a very vulnerable view of their children rather than a resilient view of their children, means that parents are naturally maybe a bit more worried than they might have been in other generations where kids were just allowed to get on with it.
Yeah. One last thing, and we're going to be finishing in a minute or two, Sammy. Very, yep. Very good and interesting hour. And that is bonding. You know, the British psychoanalysts, who were actually much more than psychoanalysts, but led by Bowlby, yep. Talked a lot about the bonding, right. Human bonding. Yeah. And so important is the loving bond between parents, yes. And children. And above all things, I strive with the kids and parents I work with to strengthen the loving bond. Yep. And sometimes parents, very often actually, will honestly say as we talk about it, and I try to help them not feel guilty the way you do, that there was a period of time at age 2 or 3 when the parents were working too hard or the parents were in conflict or one of the parents was away a lot. And so a bond failed to fully develop.
Right. Yeah.
And we go to work on just working on that bond, on a loving bond.
Yes. Yes, I think that's extremely important. I kind of... I like the word bond because I think that's an everyday word. I try and keep things in everyday because I also get a bit concerned because even the attachment theory has now got taken over. So now you've got attachment disorders and people try and measure it and quantify it and say, oh, this is attachment disorder as opposed to this is ADHD and what have you. So I just talk about how secure do people feel in their relationship? Because when people feel insecure in relationships, don't be surprised if they are suspicious of getting too close to anyone. Because a lot of time there are some parents, or particularly when working with children in the care system, where the carers are struggling with this idea of these children apparently rejecting their attempts to help them. But it makes,
yes.
Perfect sense if you don't trust that adults are going to stay around, that they have a sense of who you are and your best interests. So I just
Sammy, we've run out of time.
Yeah.
That's the music,
great.
In the background. I really agree. It's a great ending point that the trust has to be built. And if your child doesn't trust you or if you don't trust each other, conflict and problems evolve. Sammy Tamimi. Sami, Sammy Tamimi, Timimi. Thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate
you
everything
so
you have to say.
Thank you for inviting me, Peter. It's been a
all
pleasure.
Right. Bye-bye.